So far this morning, we have heard ancient stories of the search for wisdom. My sermon this morning will talk about two more modern stories of the search for wisdom. My first one is three Christmas wise guys in a modernized version, adapted from Leonard Wibberly. A long time ago, I used to visit a sanitarium regularly. My mother was a patient there, and she had very little mind, if that's the right way to put it, and knew nothing of anything but of God and roses. I kept her plentifully supplied with roses, and she had been plentifully supplied with God all of her life, and so she was happy. Sometimes she would sing Irish songs to me in a thin little child's voice, and I'd have to get up and go out of the room and have a good cry. Well, visiting my mother, I got to visiting other old people around the place, and that's how I got to meet the three men I want to tell you about. They were very old, all three of them, and they shared the same room. One was very large, but in a watery kind of way. It looked as though it was liquid rather than flesh that made his skin droop around him in bulges. Another was thin and sallow and had eyes so pale and blue that at first I thought he was blind until I found him reading a newspaper with no glasses. He said he had been a professional baseball player, a catcher with the Chicago Black Sox, if that's the team that got into all those trouble years and years ago. The one said he'd been an actor and would recite Shakespeare, being particularly fond of Wolsey's parting speech to Cromwell. Oh, Cromwell, Cromwell, had I but served my God with half the zeal that I serve my king, he would not in mine age have left me naked to mine enemies. He gave a fine turn to the whole thing. The third was a small, skinny black man who said he'd once been the owner of a bank in Nashville. Anyway, these three roomed together, and they were the best of companions and told me many a story. They had no other visitors except a young girl who always came to see them in the first week of January with her baby. I thought maybe she was the granddaughter of one of them, but regarding the matter somewhat delicate, I did not inquire. It was one of the nurses who told me this story. It appeared that one time, the one who could read without glasses had been looking over the paper and discovered an item saying the first child to arrive on Christmas Day at the local hospital had been born a few seconds after midnight and was a boy weighing 7 pounds, 8 ounces, and everything's fine. The father's name was not given. You know what? One said, we ought to go and visit her. We don't even know her. They'd never let us in, said another. You underestimate my talents, said the one who recited Shakespeare. I have played before the crowned heads of Europe. A busy nurse in a maternity ward would be quite the pushover. So they decided on the adventure, but they first had some preparations to make. They had to get their best suits cleaned and ironed. They had to persuade the sanitarium people that they wanted to go for an evening stroll together. And they had to think of some birthday presents to give this new baby. But they managed everything, and the Shakespearean actor persuaded the nurse that he was the child's great-grandfather, and the thin man with the light blue eyes was the child's great-granduncle. There was some trouble over the black man, who couldn't possibly be a blood relative, but that was explained that he was a close friend of the family and a prominent citizen of Tennessee, having once owned a bank in Nashville. Well, you can't go in anyway, said the nurse, driven to her last defense. She's nursing the baby right now. Madam, said the actor, will you look at me and think how long it's been since I've seen a mother nursing her child and how much time there yet remains to me? That did it. She let them in, but stood by the door to make sure that nothing bad happened. They gathered around at the end of the bed. The mother looked up at them. We've come a long way, said the actor. 2,000 years. My name is Melicor. I bring gold for the child. He took the ring off of his finger and put it on hers. She wasn't wearing one. My wife is 50 years dead, he said. You should have this. My name is Balthazar, said the black man. I bring frankincense, and he put a scented candle beside her bed. My name is Caspar, said the third. I bring myrrh. And he produced a small bottle of perfume he had picked up at Woolworth's. My name is Mary, said the mother simply. My son comes from God. They nodded, for they were old men, and they were wise men, and they knew that this was true of every child. Well, that's the story, as I got it from the nurse at the sanitarium. And there's only one detail she left out. There was a very bright light in the sky over the hospital when the three of them arrived. But it may have been a police helicopter looking for someone. I don't know. The older I get, the less I know for sure. But if you happen to be a nurse on duty in a maternity ward at this time of year, and three old men turn up asking to visit a fatherless child, you better let them in. God knows there's enough sorrow in the world, and we could all do with a little comfort. The second story that I have for you is one that the kids probably don't know, but I bet the adults do. It is The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies, saved two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burnt with silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times Della counted it, $1.87, and the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but to flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So that's what she did, which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, smiles, with sniffles predominating. While Della is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second to take a look at the home, a furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had the word on the lookout for, but it certainly had a word on the lookout for the Menency squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox in which no letter would go, an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also on the box was a card bearing Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung into the breeze during a period of former prosperity when it was being paid $30 a week for. Now, when the income was shrunk to 20, though they were still thinking seriously about what to do, whenever he came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with a powder. She stood by the window and looked out at a dully gray cat walking by a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day. She only had $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months. With this result, $20 a week does not go very far. Expenses had been greater than she calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning something nice for him, something fine and something rare and sterling, something just a little bit near being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin, very agile person may, by observing his reflection in rapid sequence, obtain a fairly acute conception of his look. Della had mastered this art. She suddenly whirled from the window and stood before the glass, her eyes shining brilliantly. Her face had lost its color. She pulled down her hair and let it fall to full length. Now there were two possessions of James Dillingham Young in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch, which had been his father's, and before that his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to dry, just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute, and stood while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, and on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with a brilliant sparkle in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street, where she stopped and read the sign, "Madame Sonnefree's Hair Goods of All Kinds." One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, two large, white, chilly, hearty-looking, looked the Sonnefree. "Will you buy my hair?" asked Della. "I buy hair," said Madame. "Take off your hat and let's have a look at it." Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mask with a practiced hand. "Give it to me quick," said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hash metaphor, she was ransacking stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her. She hurried home with her 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on the account of the old leather strap he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way to a little prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror, longly, carefully, and critically. "If Jim doesn't kill me," she said to herself, "before he takes a second look at me, he'll say, I look like a corny Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard a step on the stair, away down to the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying a silent little prayer about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think that I am still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family? He needed a new overcoat and didn't have any gloves. Jim stepped inside the door, as immovable as a setter on the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the other sentiments she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with a peculiar expression on his face. Della got down off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had to cut off my hair and sold it because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. I'll grow it out again. You won't mind. I had to do it. I just had to. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've gotten for you." "You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact, yet even after the hardest of mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as I am? Well, anyhow, I'm me without my hair, aren't I?" Jim looked around the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone." He said this with almost an air of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Della. "I told you, I sold it. It's gone. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered." She went on with a sudden serious sweetness. "But nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put on the chops, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed to quickly wake. He enfolded his Della for 10 seconds. Let us regard with discreet scrutiny some of the inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what's the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat and threw it on the table. Don't make any mistake, Dell, he said, about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that can make me like my girl any less. But if you unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going for a while at first. White fingers and Nimble tore at a string and a paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wailing, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there they lay, the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell, with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers, but the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to pick them up with dim eyes and look to say, "My hair grows fast, Jim." But then Della leaped up like a singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly on her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dell," he said, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs, and now I suppose let's put on the chops." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Oh, all who give and receive gifts such as these are the wisest. Everywhere they are the wisest. They are the Magi.